Hello, Lightspeed listeners. I'm thrilled today to sit down with Moj Madara, CEO of BeautyCon, and bring to you a new part for our special beauty series. So BeautyCon is a media platform that combines live events, influencer marketing, and cosmetic commerce. Under Moj's leadership, BeautyCon has transformed from an invite-only YouTuber-to-YouTuber event to a B2C cosmetic summit that has sold out to crowds of over 15,000 makeup fans. So Moj possesses a real understanding for the power content creators wield in this digital age and the opportunities for influence, profit, and smart marketing therein. So today we're going to discuss her journey from newcomer to CEO, how celebrities are disrupting the beauty landscape, and the triumph of authenticity in the beauty world. So hello, Moj.
Hi. I love that intro. I'm like, I feel very, like, fancy.
That's exactly the way we want to make you feel. Before we launch into the details of BeautyCon and your perspectives, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about your personal story. You said in the past that you had an early appreciation for pop culture, you were a lover of MTV, and you were even grounded for going to concerts at a young age. So tell us about how your formative years informed your worldview and your obsession with pop culture.
Like most people who grow up first generation, your parents are overbearing and trying to maintain a cultural standard that they grew up with, and they want to like pass that cultural standard to their children. Like all things in life, the more friction sometimes you push towards something, the more that they push back. And so I don't know how else to describe it. I was really, really obsessed with radio and TV and music and magazines. It was such a contrast to what was going on inside my house. Like, it's almost like I would be a kid and I could almost see, like, what my life might be like at the end. And it just seemed not fun. Like, I was like, I don't want to be this. Like, whatever they are, I don't want to be that.
So it gave you the drive to really get to where
you are. To reject. I think I just, like, completely rejected their identity completely. I was like, just because I'm a girl, I can do what I want. And it's not always about money and it's not always about, you know, like being an engineer or being a lawyer. Like, I think immigrant cultures, when they are relocated in tragic and terrible reasons, like, I think it's one thing when people relocate out of want. I think when people relocate out of necessity, what happens is they become very tribal within their community of the people that they had to relocate with. And so they become insular in their living styles. Yeah. And so I was like, I'm an American. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I'm American and I want to be an American. And they were like, how can you, you know, like you don't love your grandmother, you don't love your aunt, you don't love your family. And so I was like, you know, maybe I don't, like, I don't know. I knew I loved, I don't know. Like, I wanted a moon man. Like, I just like was like, I want to be doing whatever they're doing on these other platforms. And so that was compelling. I don't know who else to
love that rebellious youth. And you and I actually met in 2014 at a women's Twitter brunch at South by Southwest. You were angel investing at the time and had just got into this world, actually. But tell us a little bit about your angel investments, what you look for. Tell us a bit about that.
In 2010 or 11, I was really contemplating, and I'd have been approached by a couple different MBA programs. And I never really considered an MBA program because I didn't complete my undergrad. But I was being solicited by a couple different programs to attend their executive MBA program. So I was considering it. A really, really good friend of mine was like, why would you ever do that? Like, you already have the skill set, and the only thing you would get from these programs is the network. And you have also a really strong network. And so I sort of took the money that I'd earmarked as like, that, because I'd sold my company. I had like a 1-year non-compete. I dabbled in like real estate. I'd started a development company called Native Homes where I flipped 10 houses in 1 year, all cash, all by myself with like 3 contractors. It was nuts. It was completely insane. I just like wanted to see if I could do it. I was like, I wonder if I can, like, because the market had crashed.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I have all this money. Like, what am I going to do with it? And I can't work in marketing and media. So like, I found old decrepit houses that no one had lived in for like 20 years and like would go on to the city databases and find the owners living in like random parts of this country and like convince them to sell me their houses all cash. It was like really an exercise of telemarketing and salesmanship, I guess. I essentially took the money that I thought about maybe doing an MBA program with and I put it in a check, I put it in an account, and I was like, this is my like educate money. And so I basically threw that money at companies that I thought I could add value to, but that I could also learn from. What I learned is that I'm a terrible B2B investor. I'm not very good at like platform investments. So anything that's about like enterprise is not my expertise. But, and so every investment I made on the enterprise side pretty much has, I think it's a wash. And then everything that I put in on the consumer side so far has been pretty successful. So I put in money into Harry's, I put money into Outdoor Voices, I put money into Hello Giggles, I put money into Girl Boss, a number of companies like that, that I, A, was passionate about the founder, B, I really understood who the core consumer was, C, I thought they were reaching that same consumer in a very interesting way, and I spent a lot of time with those companies. I learned from those companies, I advised those companies, and I met the founders of Harry's because I was doing some advisory work for Warby Parker. I feel like I went on a learning safari and I basically said, I will do anything and everything you ask, just want to work with these brands. And it was early in their life cycle. And in 2013, brands like Warby Parker were a small team of people, but the way that they were growth hacking their audiences through digital and social and influencers was super unique at the time. So I feel like it was like that stuff that sort of led me to the big aha moment around BeautyCon.
It's great to hear about your focus on consumer as well. I strongly believe that investing is a specialist business. And so specializing within consumer and getting a deeper knowledge there can only allow you to help your companies a lot more and allow you to really focus and hone in on those. So great to hear you say that. Now, you initially came on as an investor in BeautyCon. So what was it that you saw in BeautyCon specifically that gave you the conviction to make that switch from investor to CEO?
I think the conviction came from being involved in hundreds of brands in my career. I'd never seen people line up for something at 4 a.m, like women. I'd never seen that. Like I'd seen that for music, I'd seen that for sneakers. I'd never seen women other than like 5-year-olds for like American Girl or like, yeah. I forget what those dolls were that my dad would take my little sister to get. I forget the doll in like 90s. It was like a smushy stuffed animal thing. But I'd never seen like young adults choosing to spend hours in line to go to something and pay money to be there. And so when I saw the line for the first BeautyCon, I saw that it was like 1.5 miles long. I just was like, what the hell is this? Like, how is this trending worldwide on Twitter? How is this line 1.5 miles long? And how did I only spend like $10,000 on marketing to get all these people here? Like, that's just an unheard of. It's like everyone's dream, right? Give me $10,000 and I will get 9,500 people to show up and wait 4 hours to get in and spend 12 hours inside this venue. Like, that's a marketer's fantasy.
Yeah.
So that's why.
And actually, for anyone who's listening who's unfamiliar with BeautyCon, I'd love it if we could just take a step back and you could walk us through the experience from a participant's perspective in terms of what BeautyCon looks like right now.
Sure. BeautyCon has been, it started out as a B2B conference. And then when I stepped in, I made it a consumer-facing festival. So now those festivals are in LA, New York, London. Our largest audience to date was this past July in LA. We did 30,000 people.
Wow.
400,000+ square feet of program space. We did over 200 brands. We worked with over, I think, probably close to like 400+ traditional and digital talent. What I think about when I think about these festivals is they've become a ginormous physical marketplace and pop-up. So we've really honed in on the data side of the business and really understanding this core consumer. And now where we're taking that business is we're taking that physical marketplace online. And so now we're going to start to distribute and work with those brands that we work with through the festivals on a year-round basis and become essentially an e-commerce marketplace for those brands. And so I think we become a great digital destination now for both education and discovery. And our sweet spot has been focusing on like an ethnic and diverse audience that mostly feels underrepresented in traditional media. We also tinkered at some point with a subscription box. We tinkered with becoming a media brand and becoming a media company. So we've done our fair share of pivots in 4 years. I'm pretty proud of those pivots because I think, you know, we've shown that we are tenaciously able to like dip our toes into different verticals and test them out and see if they work for us or not. And so that's been a good exercise. And then we've also launched something called Beautycon Pop. So Beautycon Pop is a really cool new format that essentially we had so much inbound from commercial real estate partners that wanted us to bring the festivals to different markets internationally. But we can't take a $4.5 million show to 50 markets. So Beautycon Pop now takes advantage of these 5,000 to 20,000 square foot dead retail spaces that commercial, you know, investors have. And essentially they're experiential, like galleries, think of like social moment galleries with a really awesome curated pop-up retail store inside. And all of the products, like we're really excited for the upcoming Pop in LA, which launches on the 16th of November, because we're bringing 25 plus brands, but they're all, you know, founded by women, indie brands, independently held. You know, they're sort of environmentally conscious. And so like, I think we're taking a different angle at retailing, these products and product storytelling. And so now we've taken the best of these festivals. We've templatized it into a franchise that is now experiential retail, and that experiential retail is going to help us gain momentum online.
So pleased to hear you say this. I just think Facebook marketing is getting increasingly difficult and people are there on the influencer side of things. But for me, like the next step is really experiential retail. So it's great to see you guys leading the way there.
I'm so sad to say that I'm so over Instagram. It's like so sad. It's like the death of such a great product. So overwhelmed by the new features in that algorithm, not showing me like the fact that I follow 2,500 people and I see the same 25 posts and 25 people over and over again. I think people are getting fatigue from the way that these algorithms have started to dictate their content. Like what people want is choice.
Yeah.
Right? And they don't want platforms to curate that choice for them. I think most consumers think they're perfectly capable of curating their own sort of programming choices, and they just want those choices. So I think when the process of elimination has now started to happen through the algorithms, you're going to see that people are going to push through other ways of wanting to find discovery. And that's why brands like, you know, like that's why Goop is important. That's why Girl Boss is important, right? It's like people now count on curatorial voices that bring them authentic, like these are the stories I have to tell and these are the things that I think are great. Like I still think editorial is a really powerful thing.
I actually just put out a post this morning that I'll have to send to you afterwards, which is called Why Now is the Time to Invest in Media, Really? And so I agree, content is very powerful. It's just about how we use it. So talking of social media, I came across a TED Talk that you did back in 2013, where you were already speaking thoughtfully about social media influencers at the time and the power of personal branding. So what were you seeing at that time that others in the mainstream media were not seeing? How did that tie in with your involvement in Beautycon? And then let's bring that to the modern day, because I hear that you crushed a keynote from Vanity Fair this week. So tell us a little bit about that and what some of the key messages were.
So in 2013, I did not know what it meant to be a public speaker. So someone asked me to do a TED Talk about influencers, because I was like sort of running around Hollywood trying to raise money for a IP management company to essentially represent influencers and build out their IP. I thought, hey, these influencers, these bloggers and these new YouTubers, I think they're going to be really something. And I think there's no agency or management company here that's able to represent them in a way that's really about monetizing their IP. They're going to all get endorsement deals, but like who's going to really build their IP? And so this is before this was essentially saying like Jeffree Star is going to happen. This was essentially saying that like Makeup Shayla is going to happen. You've seen how these influencers have essentially become the wind behind disrupting the beauty industry. And that's why you're seeing exponential growth within these new indie categories, right? So like if you look at someone like a Huda Beauty, right? Who could have been written off as like a blogger. I wanted to essentially build an IP management company. I could not convince anyone to give me the $5 million I wanted because everyone thought, every VC was like, this is service. And every management company thought, these guys will never be as big as Beyonce. Yeah, I couldn't convince anyone. And so it's because of that business plan that I put together that actually one of the investors who had looked at that business model with me had met the original founders of Beautycon. And so it's because of that business plan that my phone rang and he said, I don't know about building this IP management company for influencers, but there is this brand called Beautycon. And so I thought, okay, if I can't convince the marketplace that a $5 million investment to build an IP management company, and people were feeling so burned because of the MCNs and not being able to monetize content. So yeah, I think ultimately it was that exercise that led me here. I spoke this week at the Vanity Fair New Establishment. I was the only keynote, and I gave a discussion on, it's called the digital ground game for the GOP and affluence versus influence. So I consider myself to be an expert on the conversation around affluence versus influence. And so to me, niche markets, independent publishers are the most potent way of creating big movements within culture, whether that culture is politics or that culture is businesses. And so it was, you know, after the election, I became quite obsessed with, well, before the election, I was obsessed with the algorithms and niche communities and how these niche communities were creating new marketing strongholds within culture. And so I gave a discussion on data analytics and how it's essentially controlling our government these days.
Wow. Okay, everybody has to listen in to that when it comes out. And you mentioned Huda Beauty in there. I guess like as we kind of look at like celebrity-founded makeup brands like Fenty, Kylie's Cosmetics, they've been recent beauty game changers. So how do you think about like how bigger name celebrity brands fit into the larger social media landscape of creators?
I think Kylie and Rihanna and Huda have really, and Anastasia have really made that format blueprint very clear. I think what they've done is tremendous. I respect all of them very much. And I think they've done an exceptional job on building a brand from the ground up, direct to consumer, which still has some integrations around brick and mortar retail. But, you know, I think that if you're sitting at a traditional beauty brand right now, you definitely are feeling very challenged, right? You're feeling, I don't want to say anxious because they're still sitting on a huge pile of, you know, a lot of baked revenue and infrastructure. But I mean, listen, if a company like Fenty goes from zero to, what is it, like $600, $700, $800 million in revenue, and Kylie Cosmetics, like even on a bad year, is doing $250 million in revenue. Like, and that's on a bad year, right? That's like on a, you know, that's the good year was closer to 440. So it's like, if that's what a reality show influencer can do, then the game has changed. The game has totally changed. It's not about traditional movie stars anymore being the face of your product lines, or maybe it is for some people, but I think it's two very different marketing strategies, and I think it's two very different approaches. I don't think that people are going to see the same ROI as they once used to by just working in through an endorsement partnership.
And then the other side of things, I'd love to just to ask you, what legacy beauty brands do you think, you know, just maybe one or two, but do you think truly understand how to navigate social? Would be good to know those couple of brands from you.
I mean, I think like brands like MAC and Clinique and even La Mer are showing up to the party and doing interesting things. I think, you know, I think Jane Huddis and John Dempsey are really smart, clever human beings. I think they're just really smart at what they do. So I think they really understand this world. You know, I think brands like L'Oreal Paris are also really investing heavily in their sort of the league and influencers. I think they're all trying to do both right now. Neither one, I can't think of a single legacy brand that's really committed to going solely on the direct to publisher influencer strategy. I think they're dabbling.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So they're dabbling and acquiring, that's for sure. Now, Moj, you have an uncanny ability to keep your finger on the pulse of pop culture. What are some companies, brands, and also trends that you are getting excited about?
I think that people really care about what's in their products. I think that's really important right now. I think the trend towards natural is real. I think skincare is a very big category that has a lot of opportunity in it. I think digestibles and health and well-being blending into beauty is also already happening and going to continue to happen. I don't think influencers go away. I don't think color goes away. I think that the audience itself has permission now to be incredibly unique and self-expressed. I don't think that changes. I don't think we're going to go to a world, like, we're not going to go back to, like, pantyhose. Right?
Definitely right.
Like, it's not going to, like, we're not going to throw back to, like, right? Like, it's just that, you know, like, okay, women are just going to only go to work in, like, a business suit. Like, that's not happening. And now the, like, when you think about brands like Bumble and the way that they've showcased female founders and the sort of, I think women have been taken out of the box. There's no putting them back in. And I think now that that's happened, there's a big roar that's coming behind it. And it's like, hey, we're competent, we're creative, we're successful. And we also like things that look and feel good. And I think that there's no stopping that now. I think it just becomes more personalized. I think people want more segmentation. I think diversity is a category that people cannot forget about anymore.
Now, Moj, you have a business to run. So before I let you go, I'd love to ask you quickly for some advice that you have for founders, creators that are our Lightspeed listeners and starting to look at maybe starting their own company, and especially in the beauty space.
My advice to you is to surround yourself with amazing mentors, investors, to continually push yourself outside the comfort zone of learning, to continually check in with yourself to make sure you're not drinking your own Kool-Aid, which I think as a founder is one of the most important things you can do, and to stay close to your consumer. I think that's like my best advice I could give anyone. It's like when I meet someone and they say they want to start a company and I ask them 10 questions about their consumer and they don't know, that's like a sign to me that they should not be in that business. And so if you're not obsessed with your consumer, and when I say obsessed, I mean like before you go to bed at night, you're like going through Instagram, you're going through media, you're like scouring for like comments, like you're looking through hashtags, like you're into this category. If you're not into this category, like you shouldn't be in this business.
Such a good point to end on. I started my career in sales, and rule 101, KYC, know your customer. So that's great advice for any founders listening. Moj, thank you so much for being with us today.
So fun being with you. It was really, really cool.
Thank you.
This podcast is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. For more details on this episode, head over to tbtpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.